tuned in to Naturopathy Earth Radio and Occult Health News, where you get the latest on medical cover-ups, government malfeasance, toxins being put in our food and home, as well as sound, clean eating principles. We are here to cast a light on what the big sick care industry and its government shills don't want you to know. Don't be a slave to Big Pharma. Break free of shackles of Big Food and start your journey now on a long, purposeful life. Become a citizen of Naturopathy Earth. Here's your host, A. Gregory Luna.
Hello, everybody. This is A. Gregory Luna. Of course, you can call me Gregory. Welcome back to another episode of Naturopathy Earth Radio and Occult Health News. I hope you're doing well today. Today, we're going to talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, which are medical devices gone awry. Before we begin, I have a little announcement to make. Confessions of an Obese Child, my memoir, my part one of my memoir, I should say, is available now on Amazon, on the Kindle, and it's also available on Barnes & Noble's Nook platform. The reason I did this was for a couple of reasons. I know the last month or so I've been releasing or giving a free copy of Confessions to people who sign up on the newsletter. And what I'm going to do now is just offer free consultation for everyone who signs up in the newsletter. I will contact you via email and talk to you and see what's going on with your life and offer any advice if you want any advice. And the main reason I put it on Amazon and Kindle and Barnes & Noble Nook is because clearly it's a way to make some money. So I'm selling the Confessions for a meager price of $2.99, which is very affordable. It's 230 pages. Now, before you're like, oh my God, that's a lot, just remember that the font size makes it longer than it really is, and it's a quick read. So I would greatly appreciate your patronage in purchasing the meager $2.99. That's cheaper than coffee from Starbucks. I would appreciate it greatly. So, of course, the website is Naturopathic Earth. Check out all the articles there, because there's a lot of articles there and recipes that we don't discuss on Cold Health News here. And of course, you can find Kate's Apothecary, the Essential Oils podcast, there as well. I am a certified wellness coach, paleo inspired. So if you're needing to lose weight or just want to readjust your diet, contact me. And as always, guys, please support the Patreon account. Donate a couple of dollars a month if you can to support this enterprise. All right, let's begin. Now, I've wanted to talk about medical devices for some time, and I've been waiting, and I picked a very fortuitous moment because Netflix is releasing on July 27th a very anticipated documentary called The Bleeding Edge, The Bleeding Edge. And The Bleeding Edge is about medical devices gone awry. And I have not watched the documentary. And I really wanted to do this episode prior to watching the documentary and prior to the release of this documentary, because I want to give it awareness, and I definitely want you to watch it. This topic is near and dear to my heart because it's very connected to Big Pharma, and you guys all know how I feel about the pharmaceutical companies and how they masquerade themselves as being this benevolent force that brings us health, when in fact, most of the time, most of their medications either placebos or cause more side effects or don't work, or they cause us to get sick. And their self-interest, well demonstrated on the two or three episodes I did about the revolving door and about medical school, their self-interest take precedence or supersede our health. And medical devices is no different. Anecdotally, I have a couple experiences with medical devices. I, of course, do not have any. But when I used to work in the OR as an X-ray tech, I used to run the C-arm, which is like the live X-ray machine that orthopedic surgeons use in the surgery room to when they're doing orthopedic work. Let's say somebody fractures their femur or whatever, they need a live X-ray machine so they know where to drill properly. Anyway, so I would see these reps, these surgical orthopedic reps, and they're part of the medical device group. I mean, There's different types, of course, and we're going to talk about like the hip replacement and all the implants and the filters and the defibrillators. And I mean, there's just billions of dollars that are made off these medical devices. Anyway, so I would see these reps come in and not just for the fractures, but I would be called in for hip replacements, knee replacements. And, you know, they would open like their suitcase of prosthetic knees, and there's different sizes, right? So that, because the doctor, like in a knee replacement and on a knee arthroplasty, they have to saw off the end of the femur and what we'd say the proximal part of the tibia. And they essentially use silly putty glue to glue the new titanium or whatever metal implant onto the end of the bone they just sawed off. But the size has got to be perfect. So these reps come in and they open the suitcase and they help the doctor size them up. Anyways, these reps make a lot of money. The other thing is the Da Vinci surgery robots. So I do teach the medical classes at a school in San Antonio, if you're not aware of that. And one of the classes I teach is clinical rotations. And in clinical rotations, it's a senior capstone class where the senior kids get to witness surgeries and births and all these awesome things. So they see a lot of Da Vinci surgeries. Now, if you're not familiar with the Da Vinci robots, robotic surgery is the future. And it's not indicated or it's not done with all types of surgery, but a lot of the abdominal removal of organs, oh, hysterectomy, cholecystectomies, the gallbladder, appendectomies, a lot of these are done by robots. And so what you do or what you would see is if you walked into this room, you would see a doctor behind a screen playing essentially with joysticks, maneuvering a sterile robot who's on the other side of the room. And the robot is doing all the cutting, all the laparoscopy work. And it's fascinating to see this. It's fascinating to see this. And ostensibly, the reason they do this is because it minimizes on complications and it minimizes bleeding. And there's a lot of intricate work that a robot can do inside of you when they're doing laparoscopy. Laparoscopy is essentially when they make four small incisions in your body and inflate it with carbon dioxide, and then they insert these trocars that have different tools and lights, and they essentially cut and burn and cauterize stuff inside of you. And so the doctor is maneuvering these trocars while looking at a television screen. So the argument behind the Da Vinci robots is that their movement is much more delicate and their cutting can be much more precise than if a surgeon was maneuvering the trocars and looking at the television screen. So when you go into the OR, and a lot of you have had surgeries, you might already know this, but a lot of your surgeries now are done by these Da Vinci robots. And there is a lot of money to be done. So I've witnessed these robot surgeries when I go and observe the kids. And I find them fascinating, but of course, so like with any robot technology, you think of the Terminator and all these other movies where the robots go awry, there is some risk. So I want to glean off Consumer Reports because Consumer Reports is still relatively reputable, and it's going to talk about some of the issues. And again, it's all about conflict of interest when it comes to big device, which is essentially just an extension of big pharma. So, tens of millions of Americans live with medical devices implanted in their bodies, artificial joints, heart defibrillators, surgical meshes. And it's a safe bet that most of them assume that someone somewhere tested the devices for safety and effectiveness. But alas, it's probably not that shocking. It's rarely the case. For most implants and other high-risk devices brought to market, manufacturers do nothing more than file some paperwork and pay the FDA a user fee of roughly $4,000, which is nothing for these guys, to start selling a product that can rack up many millions of dollars in revenue. Often, the only safety, quote, testing, close quote, that occurs is in the bodies of unsuspecting patients, so guinea pigs, essentially. As for the smaller number of high-risk products for which advanced safety studies are required, government rules allow them to be sold based on studies that are smaller and less rigorous than those required for prescription drugs. Now, if you're not familiar with prescription drugs, most drugs have to go through three phases, if I remember correctly. And I think the first is the preliminary one. The second one is testing on animals. And then the third one is testing on humans. That's why any of you college-age kids, you can always make some extra money. And most of these drug company, they have, I guess you would say, dorms or offices near college campuses, and you'll see flyers everywhere where they'll be like, do you want to make $2,000 in one weekend? You know, come to this place. And then you go there and you sign all these waivers, and they give you experimental drugs, and they give you all the food you want and video games and everything. But you're essentially a guinea pig. So the devices have a less rigorous regimen than the drugs. And honestly, the drugs really don't have a very strong regimen, because if we talked about with the revolving door, there's so much pressure put on the powers that be at the FDA, even honest ones, because most of them are former big pharma employees. So there's already a conflict of interest. But even the ethical ones, there's so much pressure, so much money that's invested in these drugs being approved, that they get approved lots of times when they shouldn't be. Quote, standards for devices exist. They just don't make sense. Close quote, says Diana Zuckerman, PhD, a vocal critic of the current system and president of the National Research Center for Women and Families. In 2011, a panel from the prestigious Institute of Medicine said the FDA should overhaul its device regulatory system because it fails to ensure patient safety before and after products go on the market. Instead, Congress is now debating a new law that would keep the present system virtually intact and ratify an agreement between the FDA and the industry to get devices on the market even faster. Shocking. And how many of these congressmen are being bribed by the whores that have the euphemism of lobbyists that work on the Hill? So instead of more regulation, Congress is pushing for less regulation between the FDA and the industry. So again, conflict of interest, venality at its core. The FDA believes, quote, the program has served American patients well, close quote, says Jeffrey Shuren, MD, director of the agency's Center for Devices and Radiologic Health. Quote, as a responsible guardian of public health, God, please, the FDA believes it's a challenge to eliminate a program without having a better alternative, close quote. And what is Dr. Shuren's connections to Big Pharma and Big Device? But an investigation by Consumer Reports, which included interviews with doctors and patients and an analysis of medical research and a device safety database maintained by the FDA, shows the following areas of concern. One, medical devices often aren't tested before they come on the market. We've already established that. What they're doing is conducting clinical trials on the American public, says Dan Walter, a political consultant from Maryland. His wife was left with heart and cognitive damage from a specialty catheter cleared without testing that malfunctioned during a procedure to treat an abnormal heartbeat. Number two, there's no systematic way for the government, researchers, or patients to spot or learn about problems with devices. Quote, a coffee maker or toaster oven has a unique serial number, so if a problem is found, the company can contact you to warn you. Your artificial hip or heart valve doesn't, close quote, says Zuckerman. Your doctor's supposed to notify you of a problem, but many may not be able to if he has retired or passed away. Number three, without major changes in the system, there's not much that patients can do to protect themselves. So we're going to talk about some anecdotal stories of particular people that had some side effects. Let's take a break. Okay, so the first person is going to be someone from my area, from Central Texas. This is Janet Holt of Floresville, Texas, which is not that far out of San Antonio. In 2007, she felt swelling in her pelvic area. She went to her gyno, who told her that her bladder and uterus had prolapsed, which means dropped out of the normal position within her pelvis. The doctor recommended a hysterectomy and a bladder lift, which is pretty standard. Now, before I ever continue, I used to show the students videos or pictures of what a prolapsed whatever looks like. And it's very important for women, especially middle-aged women, to do Kegel exercises. And we think of Kegels as ways just to tighten the vagina to make sex more pleasurable. But even though I guess that's a nice ancillary benefit, that's not the main reason you should be doing Kegels. What happens is the muscles that separate, especially in women, because there's a very small muscle lining that separates the rectum from the vagina posteriorly and then the vagina to the bladder anteriorly. So if you're not doing Kegels, these muscles get weakened. And eventually what can happen is your rectum can kind of protrude into the vagina and stick into your vagina, or your bladder can fall down into the vagina. Or you can have a uterine prolapse, which is really bad. When your uterus slides out of its normal position, slides through the vagina, it can actually come out of the vagina. So it's very common for women to get what they call the bird's nest. So Holt, quote, he talked about building a little bird's nest to hold my bladder up. He said I'd be back at work in 2 weeks. Close quote. She has yet to return to work full-time on the cattle ranch and small chain of restaurants she runs with her husband. The bird's nest turned out to be a sheet of synthetic mesh that was implanted by instruments inserted through the walls of her vagina. In the weeks and months after the surgery, she said, quote, I was in such pain I couldn't sit, I couldn't stand, I could hardly walk, close quote. Over time, the mesh shrank and shifted, eventually working its way back into the vaginal wall, an experience Holt likens to an open cigarette burn with each step that she took. Today, after 8 surgeries to adjust and remove the mesh, Holt, who is suing the device manufacturer, says she has been left with painful nerve damage in one leg. Quote, I'm 54 years old and it has totally ruined my life, close quote. Holt is one of hundreds of thousands of women implanted with transvaginal meshes for prolapse repair and bladder support since the first such product came on the market in the early 2000s. Manufacturers marketed the mesh package in a kit with tools for insertion and marketed them to doctors as an easy way to do a surgery that had traditionally required additional training. The companies were saying, quote, the salesman will show you how to do it, close quote, said Lewis Wall, professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Washington University. Despite thousands of reports of adverse events, repeated alarms by women's health and consumer health advocates, and multiple lawsuits, these products are still being sold and are still classified as moderate risk devices. In August 2011, a petition asking the FDA to take transvaginal meshes off the market, the consumer advocacy group Public Citizen called it a poster child example of the fundamental failure to protect the public's health and welfare. Well, how did it happen? How did this get on the market? The mesh manufacturers took advantage of a loophole in the law that allowed them to grandfather their products onto the market without any advanced safety testing. The way it works is before 1976, a manufacturer could sell virtually any medical device at will. That year, a new law for the first time classified medical devices into 3 risk categories, with clinical data required only for the devices in the highest risk category, which is class 3. The FDA has yet to fully enforce even that minimal testing requirement. The agency routinely clears new devices in all 3 risk classes without clinical testing, as long as the manufacturers can show they are substantially equivalent to a device that's already been sold on the manufacturing. So if you're putting the onus on the manufacturers to show safety, again, humongous conflict of interest, just like with the pharmaceutical companies. If they're the ones who prove, they're like, yeah, we'll do the studies. We'll prove that it's safe, yeah. And that's exactly what the makers of transvaginal mesh did. The mesh kits were cleared based on their, quote, substantial equivalence, quote, to an earlier mesh used to repair abdominal hernias that was sold as long ago as the 1950s. Even though the kits were designed to be used in a different part of the body and inserted laparoscopically, not through open surgery. The paradox, quote, is that companies go to the FDA and claim that a device is substantially equivalent, but when they market it, they claim it as a new and better device, says Rita Redberg, doctor, a professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. The clearance process costs manufacturers next to nothing. They pay the FDA a user fee of $4,000. It was only in January 2012, about 10 years after the first kits hit the market, that the FDA took action. It ordered 33 companies to conduct the first ever post-market safety studies of these products. The agency is thinking of reclassifying those mesh kits to the highest class level, class 3, because that requires more testing. But Shurin, the guy at the FDA who I mentioned earlier, notes that with the government's rulemaking process, quote, from the time the FDA decides to up-classify a device to the time it can actually do it takes several years, and close quote. And of course, during those several years, more of these meshes are going to be used, more money is to be made, and they're just going to slow it down. And with the whores on Hollywood, with the lobbyists, they're going to grease the skids and make sure that this doesn't get passed. All right, the next anecdotal study we're going to talk about is the lap band. In 2009, after many unsuccessful diets, Lisa Wilson, then 46, a pharmacy technician from Seattle, received the lap band adjustable gastric band. I think this is the same one that Heather got. If you go to the Confessions of an Obese Child feed, I interviewed a woman who lost a lot of weight called Heather, and she had a lap band. The implanted band constricts the size of the stomach to make it difficult to eat large quantities of food. In fact, the opening left to Wilson's stomach was so small that she had difficulty eating even small amounts of food. It also caused her to throw up almost every day. And I think Heather, she related to this too. She talked about this. But she stuck with it, losing 70 pounds until a routine endoscopy in December 2010 revealed that the band had cut into her stomach lining and would have to be removed immediately. Endoscopy is when they shove a camera down your throat. She developed a post-surgical infection that resulted in a partially collapsed lung and an 8-day hospital stay. Wilson said she has regained half of the weight she lost. Now, more than 650,000 lap bands have been sold worldwide, according to the 2010 annual report from its manufacturers, Allergan. And that was 8 years ago, so I'm sure this number is much more. It's among the minority of devices so novel that manufacturers can't find an older product for grandfathering. Those products usually have to go advanced testing for safety and effectiveness to get the FDA's approval for marketing. But the tests aren't nearly as rigorous as those required for prescription drugs, even though, as Redberg noted, quote, if you have a problem with a drug, you can just stop taking it, but you can't do that for a device implanted in your body, close quote. Amen. And the FDA charges device manufacturers only $200,000 to review a new device, compared with the $1.84 million it charges to review a new drug application. If Lisa Wilson had seen the lone study on which the approval was based, one study, she might have been surprised, or she might not have been surprised, by her problems. Of the 299 people in the study, 51%, half, resulted or reported nausea, vomiting, or both, and 25% had to have their bands removed before the end of the 3-year study because of complications or failure to lose enough weight. Quote, imagine a car had a high recall rate that high, says John Santa, MD, director of the Consumer Reports Health Rating System. Consumers and regulators would be up in arms, but in the world of medical devices, these things often stay hidden. Same for Big Pharma. The lap band clinical trial was fairly typical of such pre-marketing studies. Redberg and colleagues looked at 123 studies done on high-risk cardiovascular devices that received FDA approval between 2000 and 2007. Only 27% met the gold standard of being randomized clinical trials, according to the report published in JAMA. All right, a third one is going to be on Mr. Tower. This is a doctor. Metal hips. If any patient should have gone into a hip replacement fully informed, it was Dr. Stephen Tower, 55, an orthopedic surgeon from Anchorage, Alaska, my old state. Instead, he became the victim of another device that was grandfathered onto the market without clinical testing. In this case, it was an artificial hip introduced in 2005 by DuPuy, the orthopedic division of Johnson & Johnson. Called the ASRXL, it was distinctive because both components, the ball at the top of the femur and the socket liner inside the pelvis, were made of chrome cobalt metal. The FDA cleared it without clinical testing based on, quote, substantial equivalence, close quote, to earlier devices that we talked about. Through such metal-on-metal hips had long been on the agency's high priority list for requiring advanced clinical trials. The all-metal hips were supposedly a great advance over hips with their traditional plastic socket liner, Tower recalls. Quote, "The main reason hips traditionally failed was because of the plastic wear and tear," he says. "The metal-on-metal hip was being promoted not only commercially, but in the medical literature as being a solution for patients like me who wanted to return to a no-holds-barred physical activity." Now, just anecdotally, the total knee and hip replacements I've seen are all ball on ball. This is the common way now in the 2010s. By 2006, Tower's arthritic hip had forced him to give up practically all the outdoor pursuits he had moved to Alaska to enjoy. He had a DePuy ASR XL implanted in May of that year, and within 6 weeks, quote, "I did a double century bike race," he says. He was so enthusiastic that within 10 months, he had put various models of metal-on-metal hips in six of his patients. Remember, he's an orthopedic surgeon. But by the time a year had passed, it had become clear that something was wrong. His hip was pretty much constantly painful, and the chromium and cobalt levels in his blood were notably high. Now, I'm going to go back to this when we talk about the IUD. He says, then he started noticing other problems such as disturbed sleep, mood swings, and anxiety, hearing loss, visual problems, and tinnitus, which is ringing in your ear. Throughout that period, he says, he repeatedly questioned DePuy's engineers, design surgeons, and sales reps, quote, and they said, "Geez, Steve, we haven't heard of any of this," close quote. Right. Mm-hmm. Tower's symptoms became so severe at times that he was unable to work. Meanwhile, his research, some of which he has since published in medical journals, was uncovering evidence that metal debris from joint implants can cause what he describes as, quote, profound poisoning, close quote. After having the hip removed in 2009 and replaced with a new one made of ceramic and plastic, his symptoms have markedly improved. In August of 2010, DePuy recalled 93,000 ASR XL hips worldwide after it became clear that the device was failing far more often than average and producing serious injuries. While it's unclear how many people actually have had to have their artificial hip removed, an article in the British Medical Journal called it, quote, one of the biggest disasters in orthopedic history, close quote. Although the hip was invented and manufactured by an American company, the recall occurred because as early as 3 years previously, even as DePuy's engineers were assuring Tower that the hip had no problems, regulators in Australia, England, and Wales were noticing serious problems. They were able to do so because they have a national joint registries, a list of every joint implanted, and the ability to track how patients fare with various models. There is no such registry in the United States, although Kaiser Permanente has a large private one. Well, that doesn't offer us much consolation. The FDA has a voluntary system whereby doctors, manufacturers, and patients can report problems with medical devices. And though experts estimate that only a fraction of device problems ever get reported, from 2009 through 2011, the agency revealed 20,000 reports of injuries from metal-on-metal total hip replacements, 20,000. Of those, 15,000 concerned the now-recalled DePuy hip. Many of the remaining complaints concerned several other brands and models that are still on the market today. The 2011 Institute of Medicine panel concluded that the FDA's ability to spot problems is so inadequate, and quote, it's impossible to confidently draw broad conclusions about the safety and effectiveness of products that are on the market, close quote. All right, one of the other anecdotal ones that we're going to talk about is, and this is mentioned in the Bleeding Edge, is the Esure contraceptive device. So the way Esure, and it's E-S-S-U-R-E, it's made by Bayer, the great Nazi-funding German company. Look at the history of Bayer. Man. Also, if you ever, every time I go into an elevator and I see Koch is one of the big elevator manufacturers. They were big funders of Nazism in the 30s too, but. Don't worry, Ford Motor Company was as well. I mean, if you really want to go down conspiracy circles, there were these great books that were released I can't remember, Anthony Sutton, and it was Wall Street and the Funding of the Bolshevik Revolution and Wall Street and the Funding of Nazism. And it, great books talking about how so many American companies knowingly funded the Bolsheviks prior to the Russian Revolution and wanted them to get into power. And also the Nazis during the 30s. And these books were just mind-blowing when they came out in the 50s. And Sutton was kicked out of Stanford. He was a professor there. And when he released these books at the same time, they fired him from the Hoover Institute there because it was so damning. But anyways, going back to Esher. So Esher is kind of like a contraceptive foam that is inserted into the fallopian tubes of a woman, and the way it's supposed to work, it's supposed to, it's like a foam that kind of turns into quikrete almost, and it triggers inflammation, causing scarring and for the tubes to be sealed shut. But the device can break and fragment and migrate into other parts of the reproductive system, kind of like the way clots and embolisms float around, or even the vena cava filters that I wish we had time to talk about, and can cause everything from autoimmune diseases to neurological disorders. Now, while complications like these are pretty rare, and the ones that we've mentioned so far in this podcast are pretty rare, and acknowledged by the manufacturers, they might not be as rare as we're led to believe. Secondary subjects report that they were instructed during Escher's clinical trials to indicate that they were very satisfied with the procedure merely because they had not gotten pregnant. Well, I guess that's the main reason you have it done. But there was bleeding and pain and tremors, and all these were seen as being incidental. And the women were pressured not to report these in the literature because overall, hey, you didn't get pregnant. You know, it's not like, hey, you didn't get pregnant. And you don't have any of these symptoms like bleeding and tremors, but you're just going to have to tolerate these. Some of these women have fought to get Escher taken off the market with success throughout Europe, but it remains on the market in the United States, where, of course, the horrors, the lobbying groups wield enormous power in Washington, particularly at the FDA. Okay, so let's talk about more of the cardiovascular ones, because these are very common too. So let's talk about implantable cardioverter defibrillators. Since 2009, the FDA has received reports of close to 29,000 deaths or injuries from these devices, by far the most of any device type, according to our analysis of the FDA's database of adverse events. Implanted in more than 500,000 Americans with serious heart disorders, the defibrillators detect abnormal rhythms and administer shocks to correct them. The most troublesome aspect of these devices are the lead wires that connect them to the heart. There have been two major recalls in 2007 and 2011 of defective leads. The Medtronic Sprint Fidelis and the St. Jude Reata, after they had already been implanted in almost 350,000 patients. Patients with the device leads require close monitoring and face the prospect of having to have them surgically removed. In congressional testimony in 2009, Boston cardiologist William Mazel, MD, described what happened to a patient of his, quote, "The simple act of removing his shirt over his head caused his lead lead to fracture. He suffered a cardiac arrest in front of his wife," close quote. The patient survived but never fully recovered. This kind of reminds me of, I've been watching Homeland, not to go off topic, which I always heard was a good show. So I've been watching the first two seasons, which are very good. And there's the scene where, I guess this isn't a spoiler because it's 10 years ago or so, but 5 years ago. But the vice president dies because Brody gives the terrorist the code. And so it shocks him and kills him. But the second one are vena cava filters. These devices are placed in the vessels that return blood from the lower body to the heart and prevent pulmonary embolisms, a life-threatening condition caused by blood clots breaking loose from the leg and traveling to the lungs. Among 200,000 people get such filters each year. They're like little nets that catch these icebergs before they can get to the heart. Many should be removed once the dangers of clots have passed, but often aren't. In a November 2010 study in the Archives of Internal Medicine, Pennsylvania researchers found that pieces of the barred recovery filter had broken off and migrated elsewhere in the body in one of four study patients. One patient needed open heart surgery. Quote, "Remarkably, These filters were considered class 2 by the FDA, the same risk category of mercury thermometers, and received approval without any clinical data of safety and effectiveness, says Rita Redberg, MD, of the University of California, San Francisco. Quote, these devices were being used inconsistent with their FDA clearance, off-labeling, that's what we call it in the drug world. We don't have authority to do something about that. If you've received this device, ask your doctor whether it has been removed, says Dr. Shuren. And the last of the cardios I want to talk about are AEDs. Now, you might know AEDs from CPR, right? These are the little boxes that you apply the pads on the chest and you shock them. Found in airports and other public buildings, these devices are designed so that bystanders can operate them. AEDs automatically diagnose abnormal heart rhythms and deliver shocks to people in cardiac arrest. The problem is that they don't always work. The industry has conducted about 90 recalls over the past several years, affecting hundreds of thousands of devices. Between 2009 and 2011, the FDA received reports of 72 injuries, 686 deaths, and 20,600 malfunctions connected with the device. Arizona researchers found that in most cases, the machines weren't able to diagnose the abnormal rhythms properly or failed to deliver the recommended shock. The FDA is considering whether to downgrade AEDs from the highest risk category to moderate risk. And recalled defibrillators has been recalled 90 times in 7 years. That's amazing. And it's funny because I have to teach the kids CPR, and we don't have an AED in the classroom. There's like three or four in the high school. They're mostly in the gym. But I have to like show them how to apply the pads and all that. And it's shocking to know that the FDA has reported 600 deaths and 20,000 malfunctions of the AED. Good to know. All right, so what can be done? We always talk about, Gregory, all your episodes are always negative, the dangers of root canals, the dangers of sunscreen, the dangers of fill in the blank. I try to offer some solutions in most of these podcasts, but what can we do to fix the system? Well, the system's broken, and really, unless you could do an entire purge of our sick care industry, there's not much we can do, but there's little things that we can do. We can try to pressure, through like the Environmental Working Group or Consumer Reports. Require that implants and other life-sustaining devices be tested at least as rigorously as drugs in the food supply, neither of which occurs right now. And the practice of grandfathering high-risk new implants and life-sustaining devices, that's important, right? Because when they can grandfather them, they don't have to do the testing. Create a unique identifier system or IDs for implants so that the patients can be quickly notified about recalls and safety problems. Create a national registry that so problems can be spotted quickly and patients notified. Increase the user fees paid by manufacturers for regulatory review so that the FDA has enough money to do its job. Oh, Consumer Reports, you're so naive. Now, I don't have a problem with increasing the user fees from $4,000 and $200,000 to millions of dollars. But the FDA not having enough money, that's not why it's an inept organization. It's inept because it's the revolving door and it is run by the inmates in the asylum. So look, what can you do to protect yourself against the risks? Okay, so let's finish up and talk about some things that you can do personally. The advice I'm going to give you here is the same advice that I give you before taking any medications. Research, research, research. We have to not be ignorant sheeple anymore. We can't be trusting doctors all the time, not because they're nefarious people. It's because they're only as good as the knowledge that they have. And lots of times, they might not know all the adverse effects of the medication that they're prescribing. For example, if you go to your OBGYN and you say you're a little depressed and they prescribe you Prestique or Zoloft or something like that, they personally might not know the higher risk of suicidal and homicidal ideation that comes from it, or the withdrawal problems you have, or how studies show that the placebos are just as effective as them. They might not know that, but you trust too much. So we're all literate creatures, and so the burden is on us to read the literature. So it's going to be no different here. So when a doctor tells you, oh, you need new knees, and honestly, the best way to avoid knee replacements, hip replacements, just keep your weight down. I mean, there's always autoimmune issues, but in general, for osteoarthritis, just keep your weight down. So when a doctor's like, oh, you need this implant, you need that, you know, you should definitely consider the alternatives. Lots of times there's going to be alternatives. So you need to get a second and you need to get a third opinion. Of course, I would go to a naturopath or someone that's a little more into complementary medicine or holistic, or maybe that looks a little more askance at big pharma and the medical device industries, because there can be alternatives that might not be as invasive that you could do. The other thing, of course, you can do is research the device. Just like you're supposed to read the drug inserts, research the device. So for example, the next episode we're going to do is going to be on the IUD and the side effects of the IUD, because this is personally affects people in my life. But before you get the IUD, or if you go back to the episode on hormonal contraceptives, the dangers of hormonal contraceptives, and I think that's like episode 40, 45, nobody reads these things. So read, Google whatever the filter is, or the AED, or you had a hernia and they want to put in the mesh net, or if they want to do a colostomy bag, or just a port in your body so you can have drugs put in. I mean, there's just so many devices that they put in us. Google it. I mean, not everything you're going to find on Google is going to be accurate, but at least it'll give you an idea of what's the reputation of this product that they're going to put in you and likely have in you for the rest of your freaking life. So it's extremely important to do the research. And then once you do the research, go talk to your doctor about it. And if he's like, oh, then go find another doctor. A good doctor is going to be sympathetic to your concerns and might actually listen to your concerns. And definitely, you know, use social media, use Facebook, and find communities of people that have had this problem. Go to Reddit, for example, and look things up. Don't just be so trusting of these people. And I do want to end with this. In the documentary, they record this representative, this trade representative, a lobbyist group, Advanced Medical Technology Association, and the CEO of this group, Scott Whitaker, he's recorded, and it's in this documentary, where he says, quote, "We have more power in this room than most governments around the world," close quote. Now, that could be hyperbole, but to a certain extent, it's true that these lobbyist groups, big pharma and big food and big business and big medical devices here, they take advantage of our ignorance. They take advantage of our naivete. They take advantage of our trusting beliefs. So if they have the right spokesperson, which is going to be the doctor, right, and big advertising, pushing advertising down our throat for all these things, especially with the drugs, we'll believe whatever they say. We'll just be good, docile sheeple who nod our heads. No. Take the freaking red pill, snap out of the matrix, own your health. Because again, as I've mentioned, nobody gives a sheetrock about your health more than you, and definitely for your kids. So before you're just like, okay, I'm just going to get this device and plant it in me, blah, blah, blah. I'm going to go back and watch football all day. No, we only have ourselves to blame. Evil people exist around the world. And if you don't want to believe that, let's go biblical. When Jesus is getting tempted in the desert for 30 days, the devil comes to him and takes him to a cliff and shows him all the kingdoms of the world and says, I can give you all these kingdoms of the world if you know, bow down to me. So, I mean, they're essentially saying that the temporal powers are innately corrupt. Corruption exists and evil people exist. I'm not saying that we're going all New World Order, you know, they're Luciferians and they're half lizard people and so forth, and they're, you know, worshiping the devil. But I'm not necessarily saying that might not be a little true. But what I'm saying is that when it comes to money and power, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so when you give people this power and this authority to make so much money off of ignorant people, human nature, unless you're raised really well or have good old Catholic guilt trip, are going to take advantage of that. So these lobbyist groups, these big device groups will take advantage of you. So again, with all things, just like with dating, you got to use discernment. Use discernment. Don't bow down to pressure from your family. Don't bow down to the browbeating attitude of your doctor. Use discernment and do the research before you make a decision, because more often than not, there's going to be alternatives that are going to be less invasive. All right, guys, last thing I want to mention, of course, is hit the subscribe button. If you got in anything, a minutia, an iota of worth out of this last episode or any episode, hit the subscribe button. Episodes will be sent directly to your phone. And as always, post a review. It would only take you 2 minutes, and it means a humongous big deal for me. I will buy you a Blizzard if you do so. Until next time, guys, take care, and please spread the news and let other people know about this episode and podcast feed, and post a review for Confessions of an Elvis Child and Kate's Apothecary as well. Until next time, take care.
Thank you for listening to NPE Radio and Occult Health News. Visit our website at naturopathicearth.com. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Occult Health News, and at our Facebook page at Naturopathy Earth. Please consider a donation at patreon.com/naturopathicearth. Consider subscribing to our podcast. And as always, please post an honest review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to this. And remember the core belief at NPE: let food be thy medicine, let nature be thy healer. Until next time.